You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to All Creatures Podcast. I'm Angie, and today I have Chris with me, and I'm really excited because we're going to be talking to an incredible ocean defender. I'm talking about a whale of a conservation legend, if you will, a shepherd of the sea, and actually a modern-day heroic pirate in my eyes. My guest today is Captain Paul Watson, and he is the founder of Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. And Paul and his team have been fighting for years to protect the ocean and marine wildlife. And he has thousands of sea shepherds over 40 countries working on campaigns together to protect the world, the ocean, and the creatures that inhabit it, including anything from the vaquita porpoise to sea turtles. And some of our listeners are probably familiar with Paul and Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, as they've been featured in the reality TV series Whale Wars on Animal Planet. And Paul has recently wrote an amazing book called Orcapedia, which we'll also hear more about today. So please stick around and everyone give a big welcome to Paul Watson. Hello, Paul. Nice to see you.
Oh, thank you.
We're so excited to have you, Paul. Thank you so much.
Oh, yes, this is, I was a little nervous before the interview because it's like talking to like a rock legend of the ocean or something. Yeah. I know you're rolling your eyes, but for someone like myself that has seen you on TV and followed just your iconic journey, it's just you're a real conservation hero. And I know we're going to get a lot of our listeners excited about your work and your organization. So just to get started, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, I actually started as an activist when I was 11 years old, freeing beavers from traps and destroying traps. So I pretty well have been doing this for 60 years. I was the youngest co-founder of Greenpeace, and I left Greenpeace in 77 to establish Sea Shepherd. The reason being is that where Greenpeace is a protest organization, Sea Shepherd is an interventionist organization. We intervene against illegal activities primarily. And I also set up a strategy, which I called aggressive nonviolence. In other words, we are going to be very aggressive, but we're not going to hurt anybody. And after 42 years, we've never caused a single injury to a single person, nor have we sustained any injuries, but we have shut down literally hundreds of illegal activities on the world's ocean.
Well, and as an 11-year-old freeing beavers, which I just love that visual, and growing up loving wildlife, do you have a story with marine animals in general, which is like your aha moment when you're like, okay, I need to move from the land out in the oceans?
Well, in 1974, Robert Hunter, Dr. Paul Spong, and I steered Greenpeace in the direction of saving whales. That actually caused a schism within Greenpeace because, you know, Greenpeace was founded by Quakers and environmentalists, and the Quakers didn't want to get involved with whales and things like that. I mean, after all, when you consider that the Yankee whaling fleet was owned by the Quakers, I can understand that, I suppose. But anyway, they all dropped out, so we were free to go ahead and pursue protecting whales. Well, in 1975, we were finally out there. Our objective was to shut down the Russian whaling fleet. We found them 60 miles off the coast of California. And we had been reading a lot of Gandhi at the time, and we felt all we had to do was put our bodies between the harpoons and the whales, and they stopped killing whales. And so Robert Hunter and I found ourselves in a small little boat between the harpoons and eight magnificent sperm whales that were fleeing for their life. So every time he maneuvered the, you know, to get a shot, I would block the harpoon. And then the captain came down the catwalk and it streamed into the ear of the harpooner and then looked down on us and smiled, brought his finger across his neck. And that's when I realized Gandhi wasn't going to work for us that day. And a few moments later, there was this horrendous explosion, and this large explosive harpoon head went over our head and slammed into the backside of one of the whales in the pod. And they had struck a female, and she screamed. And, you know, whales actually scream, and we didn't realize that until that moment. And she rolled on her side. There was blood everywhere. And suddenly the largest whale in the pod rose up and slapped the water with his tail and dove. And he swam right underneath of us and threw himself out of the water straight at the bow of the Soviet harpoon vessel. But they were ready for him with an unattached harpoon. And the harpooner pulled the trigger and hit the whale in point blank right in the head. And the whale screamed, fell back in the water and rolling about in agony. And as he rolled about on the surface, I caught his eye. And he dove again. And this time I saw a trail of bloody bubbles coming straight at us real fast. And he came up and out of the water at an angle so that the next move would be to fall down on top of our little boat and crush us. And as his head came up out of the water and I looked into the eye of that whale, I was so close I could see my own reflection in the eye. I suddenly felt something. I felt that the whale understood what we were trying to do because I could see the effort he made to pull himself back. And his head began to fall back into the sea. His eye disappeared beneath the surface and he died. He could have killed the two of us, but he didn't. So I was personally indebted to that whale for the fact that I'm still alive today. But I also saw something else in that eye, and it was pity, not for himself, but for us, that we could kill so indiscriminately. And why were the Russians killing these whales? They weren't eating them. They were killing them for oil, high heat resistant spermaceti oil. And the primary demand by the Soviets was for lubricating intercontinental ballistic missiles. So I said, here we are destroying this incredibly intelligent, socially complex, self-aware, sentient being for the purpose of making a weapon meant for the mass extermination of human beings. And that's when it struck me. We're insane. Ecologically, we're certainly insane. And from that moment on, I said, look, I'm not doing this for people. I'm doing this for them and for the creatures of the sea. And that's who we represent. They're our clients. In 1986, when we sank half of Iceland's whaling fleet, I had a former colleague from Greenpeace. He said, I just want to let you know that what you did in Iceland was despicable, reprehensible, and an embarrassment to the entire movement. And I said, John, we didn't sink those ships for you. We didn't sink them for Greenpeace or for any other human being. We sank them for the whales, John. You find me one whale on this planet that disagreed with what we did, and I promise you we won't do it again.
Yeah.
Angie, I got to say, after all the people we've interviewed, and we've interviewed, I don't know, I go back to Greg Rasmussen, Painted Dogs, that story, like literally, I'm like almost in tears listening to that whaling story. Like I just, wow. I know our listeners appreciate it, but you know, thanks for sharing that, Paul. It's incredibly touching. And I could see where you would turn around and dedicate your life to the movement that you have. So thank you for sharing with that.
Well, my objective back then was the 100% eradication of whaling. And I think we've achieved that 95%. When we began, whaling was taking place by Spain and Chile and South Africa, even Australia. And today, as of last year, actually, all whaling has been confined to the territorial waters of Norway, Denmark, and Japan. No whales were killed in international waters last year for the first time ever. And so now it's really a mop-up situation. Iceland, we've managed to stop Iceland. They're officially still whaling, but they haven't killed any whales for the last 3 years. And I think that they will stop. And so fighting the pilot whale kill in the Danish Faroe Islands and whaling in Norway and Japan. Japan, we're leaving alone right now because whaling is dying in Japan. It's a dead industry. And the worst thing we can do is to get involved because it stirs up all the nationalism and everything else like that. So we're going to just let that die a natural death and focus on Norway and Japan now.
Yeah, it's so incredible. I mean, you started with this mission about ending whaling, which congratulations, as you mentioned, you are 99% of the way there, which is just incredible over your 30 to 40 year journey. But since the inception of Sea Shepherd, your organization has grown a lot from just protecting whales and the oceans. And so can you touch on a little bit of how your mission has evolved in the past years?
Well, Sea Shepherd is no longer an organization. It's actually a global movement. We're in about 42 different countries, and they're all separate entities working together under the auspices of Sea Shepherd Global, which actually runs the ships. So we have 12 ships, and right now at any given time, there's about 200 crew members from about 25 different nations on those vessels. We have two vessels right now, the Sam Simon and the Bob Barker, that are patrolling the west coast of Africa to stop poachers. We've arrested 52 poaching vessels in the waters of Liberia, Gabon, Benin, in Namibia and Tanzania over the last year. And we're also patrolling the Mediterranean against poachers and the Caribbean. We're also working off of Latin America. We're now in partnerships with Peru and Mexico with their partnerships with the governments to go after poachers. And in Africa, we're in partnerships with Liberia, Benin, Gabon, Tanzania, Namibia, San Tome, and Cape Verde. And we're being invited by more and more countries to get involved. What that means is that we can provide the resources and the volunteers, and they give us something that we don't have, which is the authority to intervene. So inside the territorial waters of countries around the world, we act in partnership with those governments that invite us in. Outside of the 200-mile limit of the territorial waters, we operate under the guidance of the United Nations World Charter for Nature, which allows for non-government organizations and individuals to uphold international conservation law, especially in areas beyond national jurisdiction. And that's one of the reasons that after 42 years, we've never been convicted of a felony crime. And anytime we've gone to court, and we've been taken to court numerous times, we've won the cases. So we operate within the boundaries of both practicality and the law. Of course, we're up against a lot of prejudice because our opposition has a lot of money. You know, these literally hundreds of millions of dollars in these industries that we're opposing. And so that can buy a lot of influence, which is one of the reasons I'm on the Interpol Red List right now. Now, the Interpol Red Notice List was put together to stop serial killers, war criminals, and major drug traffickers. I'm the only person in history to be put on that list for the charge of conspiracy to trespass. Didn't even do it, just conspiracy to trespass. But that shows you how much power Japan has. They also got Costa Rica to put me on that list for the charge of interfering with an illegal shark finning operation in Guatemalan waters at the request of the Guatemalan government, but Costa Rica charged me. But that was dismissed last year. And it was interesting, it was dismissed after a change of government. And I actually got a call from the new environment minister saying that they looked at this. And so that shows you how political it was. You can't just dismiss a charge if it was judicial, but you can if it's political. So I still have the Interpol Red List from Japan. Now, Japan doesn't really want me in Japan. They don't want to really extradite me. They just want to keep me from traveling because I'm here in the US, but they've not applied for extradition in the United States. And when I was in France, they didn't apply for extradition there. But it is convenient for countries like Canada. Even though I'm a Canadian citizen, I can't go to Canada because Canada will jump at the chance to extradite me to Japan because of our opposition to domestic salmon farms and to the Canadian seal hunt and to the wolf hunt and all these other things that are happening in Canada. So it has restricted us. But the Japanese did us a real favor in 2012 when they came after me personally, because that forced us to evolve. And Sea Shepherd is no longer me. It's no longer an organization. It's now a global movement. Because you can stop an individual and you can shut down an organization, but you can't stop a movement. And so it's made us a lot stronger.
I just want to jump in there, Angie. Like we have a really young audience too. We hear from them all the time. And they're always asking, how can I get involved? We always promote education. But just to jump in there, while you're talking about that global movement, are you recruiting help, you know, young folks to come in? And I know back in the whale wars days, you always had volunteers on the ship, and you know that's what made it fun to see how they all handled going down there to the Antarctic. But you know, what could a young person do today to help your movement?
Well, we're always looking for volunteer crew. We have people right now in Mexico pulling nets. We have people on the boats off of Africa. We have people in the Mediterranean, the Caribbean. So we're always looking for volunteer crew. So people can do that, but they can also support us as shore supporters, helping to raise funds and to support the operations of the vessel from shore. They can also support us as contributing members and supporters. But the real message I want to get across to what young people can do is to really look at what you're passionate about and get involved. The strength of an ecosystem is in diversity. Therefore, the strength of any movement is in diversity. So it doesn't matter whether your approach is litigation, legislation, education, direct action, doesn't matter, as long as you do that, what you do best, using your skills and ability to make this a better world. And all of us working together towards the same goals is what makes a movement strong. And people should really get involved in the issues that are in their own neighborhood, their own ecosystem, and try and see what they can do. Because each and every one of us can make a difference. Because of Diane Fossey, we still have mountain gorillas in Rwanda. Because of David Wingate, the Bermuda storm petrel did not go extinct. All you have to do is harness your passion to two virtues, courage and imagination, and you can change the world.
I love that. And that kind of leads right into my next topic with conservation in general. You've been on the ocean for many years and you've been looking at ocean wildlife for many years. How has the ocean changed? Is it as unhealthy as we think it is? Are the animals dying? What's going on there?
Well, I was raised in a Eastern Canadian fishing village, so I have seen the steady diminishment of the so-called fisheries, but also the number of species and the destruction of habitats there, and it has been considerable. Our oceans are dying. It's as simple as that. Since 1950, 40% of the phytoplankton population has been removed from the sea. Phytoplankton provides 70% of the oxygen that we breathe. An ocean without phytoplankton creates a planet we can't live on. Phytoplankton goes extinct, we all go extinct. If the ocean dies, we all die. It's as simple as that. But also trying to get across to people a better understanding of what the ocean is. The ocean is not the sea. The sea is one part of it. This is the planet ocean. And what that means is water in continuous circulation constantly. And that water can be in the sea, in the air, in the clouds, underground, in the ice, and in the living cells of every plant and animal on the planet. So the water in your body right now is once in the sea, once recently in ice, once underground, once in the sky. It's that continuous flow through everything that makes this a living planet. So, and every part is connected to every other part. So really, it's not just the sea that we're protecting, although that's what Sea Shepherd is focusing on, but it's every aspect of the planet ocean. And also, if you compare the planet to a spaceship, which is what it is, we're on this incredible voyage around the Milky Way galaxy, and every spaceship has a life support system. And that life support system provides us with everything we need, the food we eat, the air we breathe, and regulates climate and temperature. And that life support system on spaceship Earth is run by a crew that keeps everything running. We're not crew members. We humans, we're passengers. We're having a wonderful time entertaining ourselves, but we're not crew members. But what we are doing is we're killing crew members. And there's only so many crew members you can kill before the machinery begins to break down and it all falls apart. And with the loss of every species, it's like knocking a bolt out of the hull of a ship. You know, the ship is going to eventually sink unless we do that. We don't live on this planet without trees, without worms, without bees, without bacteria, without viruses. We don't live without those. They're essential to us. But we live in an anthropocentric reality that we've created. It's all about us. We're dominant over everything. We're superior over everything. A few years ago, I was called up by Brett Hume of Fox News, and he said, did you actually say that bees and trees and worms are more important than people? I said, yeah, I did say that. He said, well, that's outrageous. How could you say something so despicable as to say that birds and trees and worms are more important than people? I said, well, I said it because they're more important than people, because they can live here without us, but we can't live here without them. We need them. They don't need us. That makes them ecologically far more valuable than we are. So we just have to learn to live in harmony and not and to show a little humility and to understand that this world is all of us, all these species together. We have to adapt a biocentric reality. Our anthropocentric delusions have created this collective mass psychosis, which takes many forms in this thing called religion, which almost every single religion on this planet puts human beings at the center and dominant and superior to everything else. The only spiritual understandings that do not are those of indigenous cultures, which share the same thing, values that we once all shared 10, 12,000 years ago. And so that's one of the reasons Sea Shepherd is supported by so many Aboriginal communities. We've been given the Aboriginal flag from Australia, the Maori flag from New Zealand, and we're the only vessels that fly the flag of the Five Nations to the Iroquois Confederacy that was presented to us by the Mohawks, because the Mohawks say that make no decision in your life until you take into account the consequences of that decision on all future generations. And that's the kind of idea that we're trying to get across. The problem that in the world that we live in today, the geopolitical world we live in today, is people have adapted to diminishment and they have no vision into the future. They adapt to things as they diminish. For instance, if this is 1965 and I were to say to you, you know, in 40 years, you're going to be buying water in bottles, plastic bottles, and paying more for that water than the equivalent value of gasoline, you look at me like, no, nobody's going to pay more for water than gasoline. And yet we're all doing that now. We've adapted to it unquestionably. If one species of fish goes commercially extinct, we just move on to another species of fish. Back in the 90s, orange ruppy as a fish was everywhere in Trader Joe's. You don't hear about it anymore because this is a fish that takes 45 years to become sexually mature, lives to be 200 years old, and we simply couldn't keep up with our demand of it. And so this constant adaptation diminishment is going to be our undoing. And also the lack of vision. We look ahead to the next election or the next economic cycle or whatever. But to be a conservationist, you have to look ahead 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, 1,000,000 years into the future, because what we do will define what that future will be.
Yeah. Well, yes. And I just think that is hard for a lot of people to do, to live beyond the day or the month. And there has been hope, though. There is definitely stories. For every story that is sad and has an unfortunate ending, there's also several stories where people are fighting for these animals. And sometimes they win and the animal's saved, and sometimes they don't. But I think the goal is to share these positive stories. And I know at Sea Shepherd, you guys have been working to conserve ocean health big time. As you mentioned, our oceans are in crisis. And of course, working on several species besides just protecting whales from being poached. So would you mind touching on some of your current campaigns, such as Saving the Vaquita Porpoise, some of your ocean cleanup projects, to give our listeners a little more idea of how you're integrating your mission out there?
Well, the advantages of having a movement is that there's so many things happening all at once. I can't even keep track of the number of projects that are taking place. We're focusing a lot on illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing operations. And because, you know, we take more fish out of the sea than we kill animals on land. And we kill 65 billion animals in the factory farms and all that thing. The destruction of the fishes is probably one of the worst massacres of wildlife anywhere on the planet. And we don't think very much of it at all. It's just, if it's a land animal, we tend to be more concerned. I mean, there's no difference between a bluefin tuna and a cheetah, but you don't go across the Serengeti Desert mowing down everything that lives in order to capture a few cheetahs. And so that's what we're doing when we go after bluefin tuna. We're trying to protect the endangered Vaquita Porpoise. We're now in our seventh year. I'm quite confident that if it wasn't for our interventions over the last 7 years, that the Vaquita would now be extinct. We've confiscated 120,000 meters of illegal nets, and we've kept the poachers out of the Vaquita Refuge, and we can continue to do that. And we're working in partnership with the Mexican Navy to do that. We do beach cleanups around the world. We do coral propagation projects around the world. We're working to stop turtle poaching. Just last night, we actually saved 15 tortoises on the island of Mayotte off the coast of Madagascar and chased away these machete-wielding poachers who were trying to kill them. And so there's so many different campaigns, and they're all being led by very wonderful people all over the world and people in their own countries. You know, our leadership are the peoples who live in those countries. You know, Lamia Samlami, she founded Sea Shepherd France, Jeff Hansen in Australia, Michael Lowry in New Zealand, so many. We're also now in Chile and Brazil and on and on. And so this is a way you grow, really, as a movement, is to let people come up with their own ideas and don't centralize everything and try to control it. And so that's what we're doing.
So, you talked earlier about, you know, I guess coming back to whale wars, Japan, I think a lot of people don't understand, because we've covered multiple, you know, whale species. We talked about blue whales and, you know, how the demand for whale meat in Japan is just, it's not there. There just isn't a market for it, really. So right now, you know, you said the focus is Denmark with the Faroe Islands and Norway. What are some of the campaigns that are going on there, and why are they, I guess the small population on the Faroe Islands, I think it's like 50,000, right? Why are they killing so many thousands of pilot whales and some of these other animals when there's other sources of animal protein for them?
Well, the Faroe Islands actually enjoy one of the highest per capita incomes of any place on the planet. The supermarkets in the Faroe Islands have everything you can find. I mean, this is the island of sheep. There are more sheep on this island than there are people. And yet you go into the supermarket and they're selling New Zealand lamb. It doesn't make any sense to me, but they kill whales there, pilot whales and dolphins, because, well, they've been doing it for hundreds of years. That's their only excuse. It's they drop everything and go out and participate in the slaughter. It's like the only thing they really have to do for fun, I guess. But they can't eat all the whale meat because it's so heavily contaminated with methyl mercury. And we have so much documentation of them dumping entire carcasses. They weigh them down, sink them at the ocean. They just want the killing. And they try to say it's humane. It isn't. We filmed it and filmed it and filmed it over and over again. It's incredibly cruel. And this is their attitude. We're in the Faroe Islands, we'll do whatever the damn well we want, and nobody's going to come in here and tell us what to do. It's like the bullfight in Spain, although we're winning there. It's been banned in Barcelona, and it's going to be banned in southern France. And so you just have to keep going at it. No tradition should be allowed to exist that depends upon cruelty and death. And I don't care how long that tradition's been going on, it should not exist. This is, you know, we've got to be more civilized than that. You know, we have to understand that we have to respect all of these other species, and we can't use them for that kind of thing. And that includes everything like fox hunting, and also hunting itself is very, there's no reason for this stuff to be taking place in a world which is rapidly diminishing the numbers of animals. One of the problems that we have today is that in any natural ecosystem, prey-predator relationships, one of the rules of prey-predator relationships is predators can never outnumber the prey. 8 billion human beings eating meat and fish is a world out of balance. And that, yeah, it's fine if you want to be a hunter-gatherer 20,000 years ago. And it was fine to be able to adapt to diminishment back then. It was for survival. But we don't need to do that today. It's just not possible, to continue to do that and hope to survive.
Well, and most of our listeners are, the vast majority want to take action. So what are some things, I mean, the Faroe Islands, you're talking the North Atlantic, how do we influence them and or Norway to stop this whaling? It's just, it's horrific.
We send people to the Faroe Islands every year. This year, we actually sent people from Denmark to the Faroe Islands, and we have supporters in the Faroe Islands now. So it's just constantly keeping that pressure on. The other thing is, in fact, I just got a call from somebody yesterday who just got their local restaurant to stop selling Faroese salmon, to boycott Faroese salmon. So people in their own community, in their communities, can go and get the restaurants and the stores to stop selling farm-raised salmon. Should stop it anyway, but that's another reason for doing it, because of the killing of the because the waters that they kill these whales in is the same waters they're raising the fish in, and the blood that comes out of those hunts ends up going into the same ecosystem. So it's very much connected in that respect. Norway, we just have to keep the pressure on there too. Iceland has been a success story for the last 3 years. I think it's going to take. So again, here, the other thing too is people shouldn't be deterred by feelings of hopelessness that they can't do anything. The most valuable lesson I learned was back in 1973 when I volunteered for the American Indian Movement. I was a medic at the Occupation of Wounded Knee in South Dakota. We were surrounded by 3,000 federal officers who were shooting 20,000 rounds a night into the village. They killed two and wounded 46. And I went to Russell Means, who was the leader of the American Indian Movement. I said, "We don't have any hope of winning here. The odds are against us. What are we doing?" And he told me something that stayed with me for the rest of my life. He said, "We're not here because we're concerned about the odds against us. And we're not concerned about winning or losing. We're here because this is the right place to be, the right time to do it, and the right thing to do. Concentrate on the present, and that will define the future. Don't worry about the future. Just concentrate on the present, and that will create the future." And so that's what we do. I don't get depressed about the future because I'm too busy trying to shape the present. And like I said, from 77 now to now, it's 95% of all whaling has been eradicated. And we'll just keep that pressure on and keep pushing. Just never give up. Just keep going and keep doing it. And that. And there's so many people around the world who are making a difference by applying themselves in this way or that. And how do people get involved? You know, back in 1983, I get a call from a man in Scotland. He says, they're killing gray seals up here in the gray, up in the Orkney Islands. What are you going to do about it? I said, I don't know. I'm on the other side of the planet. You're in Scotland. What are you going to do about it? He said, well, what can I do about it? He said, well, so we helped him set up Sea Shepherd Group, and they were an enthusiastic bunch. They went up to the Orkneys, walked up to the sealers, literally ripped the rifles out of their hands and threw them into the ocean. And they all got arrested. And we won the case, but we also got so much publicity that we raised the money to buy that island, which is now a seal sanctuary. It's how you get involved. One of my crew members in 1979, when we chased down and ended the career of the pirate whaler Sierra, he came to me after that, and he says, I'm really concerned about the way they treat animals in laboratories, and we got to do something about it. I said, well, Alex, you know, this is Sea Shepherd. We're not going to go into any laboratories, but why don't you do something about it? And he said, well, what can I do about it? I said, well, just use your imagination and come up with something. And he went back to Maryland, got a job in one of the labs, documented everything there for a year, took it to the media, shut it down, got a lot of publicity. And then he established an organization, which today is the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mischief Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
Captain Paul, it's just so inspirational. I love your stories. I could listen to them all day.
I know, I'm on my edge of my seat.
You need to write. Yes, I want another book coming soon. Yes. Definitely an autobiography, that's for sure. And, and I know that several of our listeners are familiar, of course, with the TV series Whale Wars. But if you can maybe touch on a little bit about that and some of the tactics, the nonviolent tactics that you've been known to use, whether it's either on the boat or, like you mentioned recently, protecting nesting sea turtles or things like that. Is there a lot of door-to-door knocking? Is it a lot of education? What are some of these ways that you help defend animals and the environments they live in?
Well, we do have an educational program, but more importantly, it's an understanding of the media culture that we live in. And the understanding that the most powerful weapon that's ever been invented is the camera. So that's why we go to sea with cameras. Back in 2006, I went to all the networks. And I said, look, the biggest show on Discovery right now is a bunch of guys who are going into a very cold, remote area to catch crabs every week. And I said, I can give you men and women going to a far more remote, far more hostile, far colder region to save whales. It has to be more compelling than catching crabs every week. And so they went for it, and it became their number one show on Animal Planet, although it came under a lot of pressure from Japan and the United States government to shut it down. But so that's why we developed that. We realized a long time ago that in the media culture is easily understood. It's, in fact, there's only four elements of media. And if you understand those four elements and know how to use them, you can get a story. And those four elements are sex, scandal, violence, and celebrity. Every story has one or more of those elements. And if you have all four, you got yourself a super story. And so that's what you have to do. You have to dramatize everything. When we did Whale Wars, there was only one tactic that worked, and it worked every time. Block the slipway and keep them from loading dead whales. If they can't load dead whales, they can't catch new ones. So that was our main thing. But you know, that's going to be boring TV. So we did all things like water fights and stink bomb attacks. And that stuff was all done for show.
Yeah.
But the real tactic was blocking the slipway. And that was what was effective. We saved 6,500 whales and we shut them down. Japan is no longer in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. And as of last year, whales have been killed in international waters. And so we won that one. And we cost them over $200 million in losses. So that's one of the reasons I'm on the Interpol red list.
Yeah. I would hang my hat on that. I would put that on my gravestone, please. That is amazing. That is awesome. That is awesome.
But also, you know, there is this perception that what Sea Shepherd does is illegal, but we don't do anything illegal. In 2010, I was invited to give a talk to the FBI in Quantico, and they paid me to come give a talk. And I took it as an opportunity to explain what we do. One of the agents at the question period said, well, you know, Sea Shepherd's walking a pretty fine line when it comes to the law. And I said, yeah, well, does it really matter how fine the line is as long as you don't actually cross the line? And you couldn't disagree with me. So. But also, you know, in the 90s, they called us, you know, our opposition called us pirates. I said, okay, well, if you want us to be pirates, we'll be pirates. It's a good Aikido form. Make the accusation work for you. And we designed our own Jolly Roger, and kids love it. And it's a great marketing thing for our stuff to raise money for the ships and everything. But, you know, pirates are always really misunderstood. They're romantic figures. And also, some of the great heroes of the oceans were pirates. Mm-hmm. John Paul Jones, the founder of the United States Navy, Roger Secouf of France, Sir Francis Drake, Sir Walter Raleigh, you know, all these people were heroes, but they were all pirates. And the only bad thing you could say about that, for instance, Blackbeard used to attack ships that were carrying slaves and would free the slaves and give them a choice, go ashore or join my crew. And if you join my crew, you can rise to the level of your ability. Pirate ships in the 17th century, men, women, and people of color were equal on those ships, and they elected their own captains and officers. That was unheard of in the 17th century, way ahead of their time. And all they can come out with is say, well, they were thieves. Yes, they were thieves. They stole gold from the Spaniards.
Yeah.
And where did the Spaniards get the gold? They stole it from the Incas or the Aztecs. So, you know, and you steal gold from thieves. Are you really a thief? I don't know. But also you got to remember that in the 17th century in England, for example, a 10-year-old boy could be hung for stealing a loaf of bread. With that kind of an environment, is it much of a far stretch to say, okay, well, let's go plunder for gold. If we're going to get hung for stealing a loaf of bread, let's go for the whole banana.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why so many people were attracted to piracy. Yeah. And also piracy was able to exist in the Caribbean because of corruption. Lord Nelson was sent off to the Caribbean to control the pirates and couldn't get his ship out of Caribbean ports because of lawsuits brought against him by merchants, British merchants, who were worried that they were going to interfere with the profits of piracy. And the pirates, because there was so much corruption, so much bribes going into the pockets of government and corporations at the time, not much different than the way things are today.
Just going to say that. Not much has changed in a few centuries, right?
Yeah, depending on how the election goes, I might need to go be on my own ship and start my own pirate community.
I hear a lot of people say they're going to leave the country if Trump wins. He's not going to win, but that they're going to leave the country if he wins. But the fact is we've got to keep one thing in account. Nobody wants us.
Right, right. That is true.
To another country.
Yes. And so, Captain Paul, you obviously live a very full, amazing, and interesting life. Can you tell me a little bit more of how and why you decided to sit down and pen this new book, Orcopedia, and give our listeners a little bit of a cliff notes and background on what it's about?
Well, I've been writing books, everything from poetry to books, and I was once a journalist, and so I've been doing that all my life. But I got together with Tiffany Humphrey, who used to be my assistant. She now is living in Hawaii, and we came up with this idea to do this book, because there's really no catalog or documentation of all of the orcas that have been captured, you know, the hundreds of orcas that have been captured and how they've been treated and how many of them have died. And so we wanted to get a record of that so people can see just how big this industry, this slave industry, has been. And that's what it is. It's a slave industry. And it all started back in early 1960 with the capture of Moby Doll in the waters of Vancouver Island for the Vancouver Aquarium. And it's now emerged as a $1 billion industry. And not just orcas, of course, but also dolphins and others. And so that's one of our objectives, is to try and shut that industry down. We're suing the aquarium in France to try and shut it down. We were very successful in addressing the Russian government to release the dolphins and orcas that they had captured and they were trying to sell to China. And the tactic I used for that was, I wrote a speech to deliver to Putin and the government, but they're not going to listen to me. So I just simply sent Pamela Anderson over there to deliver the speech, and they listened to her. So this is what this book is really the documentation of all the orcas that have been captured, all the orcas that have died, the ones, each and every one of them individually, that is now are in all these different captive facilities around the world. You know, the interesting thing about, orcas, there's not one single case of an orca killing a human being in the wild. Mm-hmm. It's never happened. But Tilikum killed 3 people. Mm-hmm. Why? And people say, well, why is that? I said, well, imagine walking through the exercise yard of a maximum security prison in this country and see if you get to the other side. Tilikum was psychotic, and for good reason, pulled from her mother at a very early age, and mistreated and abused and everything. I'm surprised that he didn't kill more. I'm surprised the other orcas are so restrained. You know, this is the most formidable predator on the planet, and it doesn't attack us. You know, back in 1975, three of us jumped into the water, into the path of a oncoming pod of orcas in the Straits of Bella Bella in British Columbia. And we, you know, because we were saying, oh, whales are really nice and cuddly creatures and everything, let's go jump and swim with them. And back then, a lot of people believed that they actually ate people. Coast Guard, a captain says, you know, those things, they'll eat people all the time. And I said, well, I haven't seen a case, but, you know. So anyway, we jumped into the water with them. Now I'll tell you, when you see an orca from the deck of a boat and you see an orca while your head's just above the water, it's a completely different experience. Mm-hmm. Suddenly what I saw coming towards me were these large creatures that ate sea lions for breakfast, and sea lions were bigger than us. And we watched them, and suddenly they disappeared. Now the only thing more intimidating than an oncoming pod of orcas at the time is an oncoming pod of orcas that suddenly disappears. Now you don't care. And suddenly, a few minutes later, they just emerged right beside us. And for some ungodly reason, I just reached out and grabbed the dorsal of one of them and took off. Oh, I rode that whale for 200 meters. And then I just got flicked off with his tail. And I'm going, you don't walk up to a lion in the Serengeti. And
no, yeah.
No.
Allowed me to hold on to its fin and go along for the ride. You know, there is an intelligence there that we don't understand. You know, we tend to think that we're the most intelligent species on the planet, or the only intelligent species sometimes, but we're not. What is intelligence? Intelligence is the ability to live in harmony with your natural environment. And by that criteria, we're not very intelligent. In fact, I was arguing with a whaler one time from Norway. He says, well, Watson, you say that intelligence is the ability to live in harmony with nature, but, you know, by that criteria, cockroaches are more intelligent than we are. I said, George, you're beginning to understand what I'm trying to tell you.
Yes.
All animals are intelligent relative to their ecosystem. But when you look at cetaceans, now you're looking at something completely different. The human, the average human brain is 1,700 cubic centimeters. And the average orca brain is 6,000 cubic centimeters. And the average sperm whale brain is 9,000 cubic centimeters. These are big brain creatures. And big brains mean something. But more importantly, all cetacean brains are 4 parts to that, with a very large area for for thinking and communication and everything. And the other thing is that the convolutions on the neocortex of orcas and sperm whales are so much more pronounced than on human beings. There's more brain matter on that. This is an intelligent creature, but we measure our intelligence by hand-to-eye coordination, the ability to make tools. If you don't drive a car, you don't talk on a telephone or wear a dress, then you're not intelligent. That's our way of looking at it. But whales don't need telephones. They can communicate over long distance with each other. They don't need cars. They don't need boats. They don't need to wear clothing. I mean, they don't need any of this stuff. It's a non-utilitarian intelligence, but when it comes to communications, they're far above, more superior than we are. Their communication abilities are just absolutely incredible. Dolphins have learned to speak English words. We haven't learned one word of dolphin. No. And in order to speak those English words, they actually had to take a couple of months to slow everything down, because cetaceans transmit information the way our computers do, large bits of information in sounds. They see with their ears. And, I believe that if we spent our energies trying to understand and communicate with orcas, that we would achieve far more than and learn a lot more. Although I'm not sure we want to hear what they have to say if we eventually have to speak.
Yeah.
But a lot of scientists who have been working towards that, that objective is to find ways of interspecies communications. Here's how insane we as a human beings are. We're spending billions of dollars searching through the universe looking for extraterrestrial life. We go completely nuts by the possibility there might be some bacteria in the clouds of Venus.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet we're killing life on this planet like it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just absolutely insane.
Well, in life that we haven't even fully discovered, like you said, how they communicate, their physiology. I mean, doing this podcast and studying a lot of their behavior and physiology and the way they communicate, Chris and I have learned so much about little, just a teeny tiny foot in the door of what these animals are capable of doing. And even if you're not an animal person, these animals have things that can benefit us, help cancer research, help biomedical things. I mean, just like their secrets to life, they have a lot more answers, I think, than we give them credit for. And we're not even.
Well, one of the problems when it comes to that is we spend literally billions of dollars, researching things like cancer and everything and torturing millions of animals to try and find a cure. But we spend nothing on trying to prevent it.
Exactly. True. I mean, there's so much nature's given us. I always say to a lot of my students in the rainforest, I'm like, there's probably something out there that could be very helpful, either as a, like you said, as a preventative, and off it goes. We are just totally missing it. And before we've even given it a chance. And so it's just, like you said, I think as the alleged most intelligent creature, I think we're one of the more insane ones. That's for sure.
Yeah, we're just maybe intelligent, but crazy. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Now,
right now, the breakdown is something that climate change is leading to, but it also is being caused by diminishment of diversity and diminishment of interdependence. And we're going to see more and more of it. That is emerging viruses. And, over the last 20 years, we've had hantavirus reemerge, West Nile virus, SARS, Zika, Ebola, all of these things. Nothing has really hit until now that's been global, which is global COVID-19. But COVID-19 is just a harbinger of worse things to come for two reasons. One, as we diminish in ecosystems and diminish species, we're going to create more and more zoonotic transmission of viruses. Viruses are absolutely essential for life on this planet. Every plant and every animal has viruses associated with them. It makes it possible for us to live. But when you diminish a species or destroy an ecosystem, you create a situation where the viruses associated with those particular species have nowhere to go. And ones that are closely related to us, be it bats or primates, whatever, they're going to look for something that's attractive. And humans, 8 billion humans, that's pretty attractive. Mm-hmm. We're going to jump on that. They don't want to kill the host. That period of coexistence, to develop that coexistence, is going to kill a lot of hosts in the process. But also we have the other thing is the emergence of new pathogens or novel pathogens that have been lying dormant in the permafrost for 20, 30, 40, 50,000 years. Already we've had an outbreak of up in Finland of anthrax, which killed a number of reindeer and a few human beings. So this is not anything that anybody's taking very seriously. You know, yes, wearing masks and social distancing, that's going to help right now. But if you really want to address this, start protecting the ecosystems and the species that prevent us from, you know, catching these viruses. Put an end to factory farming. Those are just petri dishes that are, we're putting out there. Not just, we always talk about the wet markets in China. They're no different than the factory farms of in the US and in Europe. They just put to death 2 million mink in Europe because they've got COVID-19, you know? And so all of these things are the problem of the way we destroy animals, 65 billion of them every year. That's a mind-boggling number that we kill. It contributes more greenhouse gas emissions than the entire transportation industry. You know, it's the leading cause of groundwater pollution. It's the leading cause of death zones in the oceans. And yet we just don't want to, we don't want to address it because it's inconvenient. You know, we like our hot dogs. Yeah. We like our steaks. We like our dairy products. We, you know, and everybody wants to change, but everybody wants things to change, but they don't want to change themselves. And that's the real problem. If we're going to have a world, you know, the world I was born in had 3 billion people, and now it's close to 8 billion, and I'm still alive, you know? So what's the world of 50 years from now going to be like? You know, I keep hearing these reports saying, well, you know, the world population is not going to be more than 12 billion by the end of the century. What can they say that on? Based on my experience in the last 60 years, 3 billion became 8 billion. So what? Why is 8 billion only going to be 12 billion in 100 years? It just doesn't make sense. They're just saying the things that we want to hear. The other problem that we have is that all change has to come from the passion of individuals, and it is not going to come from governments or corporations. Mm-hmm. Governments will not do change because it's not in their interests. 30 years ago, the conservative prime minister of Canada, Joe Clark, did something really good. He said, we have to really recognize that the true value of a gallon of gasoline is, so I'm going to raise the price to reflect what the true value is, and we're going to then have to take things, you know, this is way ahead of his time. 6 months later, he was no longer prime minister. Mm-hmm. Any world leader who comes up and seriously addresses climate change, who seriously addresses the environmental issues, is going to be tossed out on his ass by the electorate because they don't want to hear that message. Mm-hmm. They simply don't. And that, and this is why you have, you know, we all know fracking's bad, but the Democrats are not going to condemn fracking because, well, there's jobs that are involved in it, you know. I mean, what are the good of jobs if there's nothing left to have a job about? You know, by 2048, there's not going to be any fishing industry because there won't be any fish.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, for yeah. hundreds of years in Polynesia, the shamans would have this thing called kapu. They would declare a bay, kapu, no fishing in this bay for 20 years. Anybody caught fishing, it was a death penalty. People say, well, that's a little extreme, the death penalty for fishing. No, the shamans understood something, that if the fish died, if they disappeared, so would they. Their very survival depended upon those fish not disappearing. And so, but there's no kapu areas anywhere in the world today. There's no place where the fish can go. You know, Rayathon produces a fish finding device, and its motto is the fish can run, but they can't hide. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. The fish have nowhere to go. And we're just taking them out like they're just this, like they're corn in a wheat field or corn in a cornfield. We're just taking them down. We don't care about whether they survive or not. We don't care about their future. You take a look at the average size of a North Atlantic codfish in 1900. It was about up to 2 meters, now 18 inches. And, you know, the best way to find to compare this, because we forget we adapt to diminish, but the best way to look at this is to look at pictures from sports fishermen back in those days and see the giant, the size of those fish and everything.
Yeah.
We don't see them anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, and obviously the pandemic is something we've never experienced in our lifetime. And of course, it's just been horrific for many people, many families across the globe. I like to try to be hopeful and think of, okay, well, what good can come from this pandemic or what can we learn? And gal, I mean, one of my hopes is that a lot of people will start at least here in the States, considering science, that it's very important and we need more of it. And then also I think that we are all interconnected and we need to understand that if we're going to, like you said, survive or live together. And obviously I might just, you know, I might just be all hope and no realism there, but I think that it is time for our movement to really push forward and excel and get the younger people. I mean, they're the ones that are going to inherit this mess that we've created, and really start just kind of taking charge, as you mentioned, and knowing that you can't really sit back on your heels and wait for the government to do it, because we've been doing that for, I mean, I was an environmental sciences major 20 years ago and it didn't, you know, we're moving backwards, especially in our country. So hopefully this can be a wake up call, I think, to a lot of people as far as science and interconnectedness go, at least is my hope. But from your point of view, Captain Paul, I was wondering, has COVID-19 impacted Sea Shepherd?
Well, it has. It's certainly created obstacles. So, you know, we're getting our ships are out there, but we have to go through quarantines to get the vessels out of there. One of our vessels has been stuck in Singapore since March because it can't leave because of restrictions there. Captain Peter Hammerstead, who is in charge of our African campaigns, 2 days ago, he arrived in Benin. And of course, they test you when you get in there. You know, the African nations are actually far better at testing than we are. And he discovered, much to his surprise, that he tested positive for COVID-19 antibodies, which meant he had it, but he didn't even know he had it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So, you know, things, at least for the next year, things are going to be certainly difficult. And I don't know how things are going to be after that. But, you know, this country's acting very unwisely and how they're dealing with it. I live in Vermont, which is actually the best state in the country right now for things, but I don't understand why, because I go out on the street right here and there are license plates from Texas and Missouri and Florida. And you're supposed to have a 14-day quarantine when you come into Vermont. There's no way these people are doing that, but there's nothing to police it. There's nothing to enforce it. So I'm surprised that we haven't had a spike because of that. But of course, there's mandatory masks, you know, in Woodstock here. It's illegal not to wear a mask. So Vermont's a little ahead of the time in that. But there's so much stupidity when it comes to this. I mean, all they have to do is read a history book and look at what things were like in 1918, 1919, and how they had to deal with it then. And they had a worse time than us because they just came out of this horrendous war and then were hit with this influenza epidemic. But they dealt with it, so we should be able to too now. But again, if we don't deal with it on the long term, then it's going to get worse, and then what we have now will be insignificant compared to what comes down the road. And in addition to that, we have all the problems like flooding and fires and all the consequences of climate change.
So would you say climate change is probably I mean, we've had numerous scientists and conservationists on here, but would you say climate change is the number one issue that is affecting the oceans the most in the long term?
Well, there's many things affecting the oceans. Climate change, one of them, plastic pollution, radiation, chemical pollution, overfishing, plastic pollution, all of these things are contributing towards the diminishment of the ocean to support, or the seas to support themselves. But climate change is a major problem. I just finished writing a book, but it's in the French language on climate change, which has just been published last month in France. And what I was going back to is the Permian extinction in 250 million years ago, which was caused by the same thing, but that was because of massive volcanoes and burning coal mines in Siberia. But, you know, the parts per million in the air now is the same as the beginning of the Permian extinction. And the Permian extinction reached 1,500 parts per million, which was pretty bad. But we're heading in that same direction. And, you know, world leaders just don't see it. They just don't see it. And everybody, you know, people say, well, oh, 1%, what, 1 or 2 degrees? It's not going to make a difference. It's going to make a hell of a difference, you know. And the other thing is that now we've got these things. We had climate change deniers. Now we have climate change enablers. People are saying, well, this is going to be great. It's going to be good for tourism. They're going to open up the fisheries up in the Arctic. We're going to do this. The growing season is going to be better, you know. So now they're trying to put a positive spin on how great and wonderful this is going to be. I don't think they really understand the dynamics of what the changing climate really involves. Because, well, you know, when the temperature is going to raise 1 or 2 degrees, that might be overall That could be 10, 15 degrees in certain parts of the country. Australia is going to be hit really hard. So yeah. The equatorial areas are going to be unlivable.
And so for some of our younger or even older audience that's listening, and of course, a lot of your words I know are ringing very true to me, myself and Chris, what advice do you have for people that are interested in a career of marine animal conservation, ocean conservation? What would you tell them? How would you inspire them?
I used to joke that if you really wanted to have a voice, then study acting or music.
Yeah, true.
Mm-hmm. But I say follow your passions. What are you interested in? Is it science? Is it art? Is it education? What really are you inspired by? And go for that and develop those skills and put them to use. That's really the best you can. Don't try to be something that you just are not. You know, if you're inclined to be an artist, then be an artist. If you're inclined to be a lawyer, be a lawyer. But you know, make it work. And that's, you know, I can't tell people what to do on that. But I can certainly say, follow as Joseph Campbell once said, follow your bliss, go with your passions.
Yes, I think there's a voice for everyone. Like you said, if you want to be a lawyer, you can still do environmental law. Or if you want to be an artist, you can do conservation pieces and things like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's definitely, the more I do this podcast, it's definitely not a one size fits all type conservation movement. And I think we need more actors and players from different areas to spread the message and keep the movement going and bring their own, as you mentioned, creativity and their talent to the table.
Yeah. When people say, I disagree with what you're doing, I say, that's fine. Do whatever you're doing. I don't care. You know.
Right. Yeah. Do something else. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oh, wow. And now with your new book, The Orcapedia, how can our listeners find out more information about that? Get the book. Is it on seashepherd.org or how is it available?
Well, it's on seashepherd.org. It's in the bookstores and it's on Amazon, of course. So it's readily available. You know, people can find it. Just type it in Orcapedia, really.
Yes, I have my copy right here. And I must admit, I'm really enjoying just the pictures and the historical background and really giving a name and a story to each orca and their lineage. And it's just so very interesting. And definitely, I feel as though it's a tribute to these beautiful creatures and to their lives. Some of, like you mentioned, were taken brutally. And of course, some of them that are still existing. It's awesome. And I love to, towards the end of the book, you mention some of these alternatives to keeping orcas in captivity. You talk about sea pens, and of course, another ideal alternative being whale watching. Would you mind commenting just a little bit on sea pens and where we're at with that? And is that a realistic, futuristic way that we could perhaps interact with orcas, but where they're in a more natural habitat?
I wouldn't advocate sea pens for people's entertainment or, you know, sea pens are a device in order to train and rehabilitate orcas back into their natural environment. And what mm-hmm. that means is getting a large area like a bay, netting that bay off, and then teaching the orcas how to survive there. And I think it's possible. Keiko was released and survived. Keiko died of pneumonia, which he had picked up in captivity. But he was taking care of himself for the months and months at a time. Mm-hmm. So it's possible to rehabilitate. And that's what the sea pens are meant to do, rehabilitate, not to hold them for amusement or anything.
That's great. Now, I spent the hours has flown by. I'm like on the edge of my seat. How can our listeners help Sea Shepherd? I mean, they go to seashepherd.org. I definitely want to order my shirt. My sister asked me to tell you, years ago, you gave her a tour of Sea Shepherd. She was at the Cannes Film Festival with one of her celebrity friends. And I remember you only had one shirt and Michelle got it and she didn't. So I got to get her one. But how can our listeners help support you and your efforts and your organization?
Was that Michelle Rodriguez?
Yeah. Way back. My sister was the tall, skinny one.
She actually became a crew member.
Yeah. She was coming on. Yeah.
Well, people can, like I said, they can volunteer to be on the ships. They can volunteer to be sheriff supporters that become mm-hmm. members of the chapters we have around the world. Yeah. They can become contributing supporters. Those are all the different ways to get involved with Sea Shepherd or do whatever you feel inclined to do in whatever area you choose to do it. It all you know, contributes towards the same end.
I just want to say, Paul, Captain Paul Watson, the one thing that stands out the most is, as you said, be present, stay in the present, and be active and do something about it. So I hope our listeners took that message, because that it just my chills down my spine listening to you talk. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Yes, Captain Paul, thank you so much for being here today. It's like, yeah, it's definitely like one of my conservation rock star hero moments. So I really appreciate you agreeing to this interview and sharing your stories and your knowledge. I look forward to hearing more. Like I said, I want that autobiography with all these stories in writing so I can highlight them, and all of your words of wisdom have just been really touching today for myself, and I'm sure I can speak for our listeners. So thank you so much. And for all of our listeners out there, Chris and I will put show notes on our website as far as how you can check out and learn more information about Sea Shepherd. And of course, they have a great social media presence. So I highly recommend you check out their different platforms. There's tons of education pieces on there, ways you can help stay informed. And although a lot of us are at home right now with COVID-19, there's definitely ways that you can get involved from your couch. And a lot of that is on social media and just sharing information. A great way to start is, if you have not watched Whale Wars, get started there. That'll definitely hopefully inspire you to this movement of what Sea Shepherd has been doing and what they're going to continue to do. And they definitely need more conservation heroes out there. So thank you, Captain Paul. It's been a pleasure today.
Oh, thank you.